You're listening to a Wheels on the Ground production.
Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of Crypt Times.
Today on Crypt Times, we're joined by Cindy Baker, an interdisciplinary contemporary artist, with your hosts, Yusuf and Christina.
So, Cindy, thank you so much for being with us today and being a part of this podcast project that we've been working on. We are so excited to be able to share you and share your practice with our listeners and our communities. So for folks who might not be familiar with you and your practice, if you could just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your practice, that would be amazing.
Great, thanks, Christina. I'm a contemporary, interdisciplinary, and performance artist, basically, the shorthand version of that is that I make things and I do stuff. The slightly longer, more involved version is that I have a research-based practice that covers a variety of mediums and genres. So I sort of move between the arts, humanities, and social sciences, and I work with all different kinds of materials and techniques, from low craft to digital fabrication to performance, and sort of think of my ideas as the primary medium or the concepts. So I wouldn't necessarily call myself a conceptual artist because my work is very material, but focusing very much on the ideas and the concepts.
Amazing. And obviously we are in the midst of a global pandemic that is kind of impacting crypt folks, crypt body mind in ways that it isn't impacting non-disabled folks. So I guess the question that I want to ask you is about you and how are you today? How is your body mind today? And how are you dealing with this pandemic that we find ourselves in?
My mind is a bit wobbly, which has come to be my new normal, at least for now, although wobbly is kind of a state that I wobble in and out of normally. It's summer, which is a little more difficult for me too, because the heat isn't so great for my brain. So today is one of those days that I'm a bit off kilter. I find though, and you may agree with me or not, we'll see. It's an interesting conversation to have that I feel like I have better skills for dealing with this kind of thing, the pandemic, and what it does to our brains and our bodies because of the fact that we deal with, as disabled people, we deal with these kinds of pressures all the time.
I think this is a conversation that I think is being had in a lot of crypt communities, the fact that not only we had better skills and how to navigate things like isolation, but also that these additions into society are things that crypt folks, disabled folks had been advocating for a really long time. Things like remote work, things like captioning and digital meetings, et cetera, so forth. And now they are being seen as essential because also disabled and non-disabled need them. And it's kind of just interesting that this pandemic has shifted the way we view needs in terms of serving folks in isolated spaces, which there have been a lot of disabled folks who had been isolated due to ableism in our society long before this pandemic started.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you spoke a little bit about, you used the term wobbly to describe like kind of the place that the heat's put your brain in, and like also, I guess you've spoken a little bit about the environment and like what's happening and the way in which our bodies are reacting to the pandemic and things like that. And I find that really interesting because I've seen that reflected in your art practice, or what I've seen of your art practice. Thinking back to the piece that you had at Tangled, I think in 2017 or 2018?
Yeah, end of 2017, yeah.
Yeah, yes. I was wondering if you might be able to share a little bit with our listeners about what that piece was, to give a little bit more insight into your creative practice.
Sure. So the project that I did at Tangled is called Crash Pad. And physically, the work that you would see in the gallery is a large bed that's shaped like a pill packet. It's about 8 feet across. So if you can imagine a little blister packet with a pill in it, it's kind of that plastic foil with a little bump in the middle that the pill rests in, and then a piece of foil that you either peel back or you push the pill up through. And for me, it was kind of a portrait of my favorite pill. And in the middle of it, instead of a pill, there's a mattress that's shaped like a pill. So this bed becomes a prop for me to have a relationship with this pill that I sort of, for the purposes of this performance, consider a lover. So it's both the lover and the bed. And I use it to be able to interact with it and to allow the audience to see me and my relationship to my bed and my relationship to my medication and how I interact with it. The piece is also an opportunity for me to let the public see an artist who is working hard at resisting the impulse to work hard.
Amazing. So Tangled, as a lot of people do know, is a disability art gallery. In your own words, can you describe what you believe disability arts is?
Sure. To me, disability art is, at its most basic, any art made by people with disabilities of all kinds. I don't think it necessarily used to be that simple of a definition, but I think where we're at with it is that anybody who makes art that is disabled can claim themselves as a disability artist, whether or not the subject matters they're using actually approach it in a really direct way. And I think that's, for me, exactly because of the fact that everything that we do as disabled artists comes from the lens of, you know, seeing things through our experience as people who are affected by disabilities.
Right, and what would you say is kind of like the importance of disability arts within the broader art sector within Canada and within the global society?
I think disabled people need to see their experiences reflected in the culture, and they need to see those experiences as made by people who are affected, not represented by people on the outside. And I think all marginalized peoples are going through the same sort of revolution right now. You know, we want our representation to be by us and for us. And we want people to see our experiences and hear them through our own voices.
What do you think of the notion, or rather, how does your art come up against the notion of a good body being a productive body?
Yeah. I think I push against the notion of productivity very hard in my work. I really think that our neoliberal society expects a certain kind of productivity out of us. Their definition of productivity really has to do with making the capitalist machine run. And so things like notions of self-care are not actually about taking care of ourselves, but are about ensuring that we continue to be productive cogs in the machine. So in my work a lot, I do push against the idea that we should be cogs in a machine at all. And I ask people to question what productivity is, why there's an imperative to be productive, and how that's actually damaging for our bodies. And not just damaging, but in fact, because we sort of not only have this neoliberal imperative to be productive, but that there's a moral imperative as well, that health has become a moral imperative in our society. And that means that to be productive is to be good, to be healthy is to be good, is to be a good person and a person who is not just healthy, whatever the, you know, however you want to define healthy, and abled, but also beautiful, because beauty is equated to health and to productivity in our society. So everyone who fails at being a perfect standard of beauty and a perfectly abled person in all of the ways that that's defined is actually seen as lesser than, less productive, less valued in our society.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. That also brings up, though, I think there's also, though, the ableist notion of good art comes from suffering, or from disabled people suffering. So what is your response then in juxtaposition to that, as well as the, you know, self-care crowd?
Not only does good art supposedly come from suffering, but that the best artists are pushing themselves constantly, right? So there's two, I think, good art coming from suffering is sort of a mental, an idea of mentally what we're supposed to be going through as artists, this sort of anguish and sort of mental instability, possibly putting ourselves emotionally in a place that's very damaging. And then on top of that, pushing our bodies and struggling in a way that that pushes our bodies to the limit in ways that impact disabled artists more than they would impact artists without disabilities, or able-bodied artists, however you define that. Especially as a performance artist, I see performance art, the better the art in theory, the more somebody is really having art that takes a toll on their body, right? Like they're struggling, they're bleeding, they're sweating, they're holding up massive weights or putting themselves through trials and tribulations that that sort of quote normal bodies would have a difficult time withstanding. So disabled artists, obviously, we're coming from a place where maybe we can't withstand or aren't able to do some of those things at all to begin with. So what does that mean about me as an artist? Am I a failure as an artist before I even begin?
What are some ways that you build this resistance into your practice? Not only the like making of art, but also the performance of your work. Like, what are some of those ways in which resistance is integral, or what are some of the ways that resistance is brought in on like the grounding effort?
Wow, that's a good question. I think I try to build my art to be accessible on many different levels for the audience. And one of the most basic levels is that people can understand what they see, like on a really basic level. So with Crash Pad, for instance, people see me in a very vulnerable place. Even when I'm just lying, even when I'm sleeping in the gallery, what they're seeing is something that they absolutely can't deny is impactful or vulnerable or beautiful, however you might define that. And so right away people say, okay, maybe this is good art, or maybe this is something worth looking at. And at the same time, I recognize that what's happening is not productive in ways that I've been led to believe productivity should act. And so there's a question right away at the beginning, right? I don't necessarily have answers. I don't necessarily have a big statement that I'm trying to make with each work. I'm hoping that those statements build, and that if you're following my practice, or if you're following disability arts, if you're following people with the same ideas, that it starts to build, that your idea of this resistance really starts to build. But for one, I just want to start really quietly and say, this is me resisting, you're witnessing me resisting, and it's valuable. You can see, at least on one little level, that it's valuable.
Are there any times, and this might be a little bit of a vulnerable question, so we can move on if you don't want to answer it, but are there any times that you've had to surveil your own thoughts and your own practices that maybe you are judging yourself in a capitalist or a productive way? Like, are there times in which, even with the best of intentions, you still see yourself falling into a capitalist notion of productivity?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. All the time, because as much as I sort of feel like I'm looking through the world with a critical lens, I also recognize that all we can do as people is look at the world through the lens that has been given to us by society, right? I'm looking at the world through a lens of someone that is critical of what my abilities are, and that is, you know, everything that I'm criticizing is a part of the lens that I'm viewing culture through. So when I perform Crash Pad, when I perform any of these works that are meant to be a way for me to resist productivity or resist capitalism, all these things, I still have the impulse to perform and to be a good body. And every time I make a new performance, I think, oh, this is very thoughtful, and it's very intellectual, and it's very smart. And then I do the work and I'm like, oh my God, it's very physical. First of all, I forget that it's physical until I make the work, until I do the work. And then I find myself trying to, like, because I recognize that it's physical, I'm like, okay, let's lean into the physicality and let's figure out how to make this work, given that it's physical. And I'm constantly fighting against that urge to perform, sort of capital P with quotes around it, perform.
So we talked a lot about how your work is influenced by anti-capitalism. I was hoping that you could expand upon how anti-capitalism works in tangent with other anti-capitalist politics, much like a crip politic, a queer politic, and a fat politic.
Sure. I think as an intellectual, I have a grounding in queer theory and disability theory and fat theory as well. So a lot of my language and a lot of my politics comes straight out of very theoretical and political lens. And I think all of those theories are by nature anti-capitalist and anti-corporate and anti-neoliberalist. Maybe this is a bit of a blunt weapon, but I think that intellectualism and academia in general are very anti-capitalist, and that it's very difficult to be an academic or an intellectual and still toe the line of a capitalist society, which is, I think, why intellectualism is so dangerous to capitalism. I'm not sure how to talk about those things specifically and how they intersect, except to say that that, as I was talking about before, about cogs in the machine, disabled people, queer people, fat people, we don't fit the molds of the cogs that are needed to make the machine run. Anytime that we trouble the machine in any way, it's running less efficiently. And so capitalism is constantly trying to smooth out the edges, and anybody on the margins just doesn't fit. And either you become molded to fit and you start living a life that tries to shoehorn your body into that machine, or you find yourself on the outside of it?
Yeah. And speaking about like the cogs of capitalism, it seems they have been gummed up a little bit recently by the, you know, current pandemic that we are collectively living in. How has the pandemic and sort of what's happening in the world impacted your art process and what you're creating and doing with yourself now in you know, these times, these weird times that we find ourselves in?
I think, like we talked about earlier in the interview, because my mental processes have been affected, that has had one of the biggest impacts on my artistic process. And that's been really difficult for me because I rely on my brain to do the bulk of the work of my practice. I think I'm impacted in the same way a lot of artists are, both inside and outside of disability arts, which is that there are fewer opportunities for me just because everyone has slowed down and had to reassess what it means to program, what it means to exhibit art. So there are a few small opportunities that have come up that are like performances that happen virtually or performances that happen offsite and all these little ways that people are trying to make do, but it does feel in a lot of ways currently like making do. And I want to make do, but I also don't want to have to make do. I want to make. And I want to continue making. And I don't want for us to equate, especially as disabled artists, I don't want us to equate the way people are cobbling together provisional exhibitions with the way that we should be working as disabled artists. Like, oh, this is easier for us. Like, we can stay home or we can stay in bed and make, and, you know, we can program virtually through Zoom. I don't want that to be the default. Like, it feels like second best, and I don't want the way we work to be considered sort of equated with that sort of second best way of programming.
So then I'll go back to a word that's come up a lot in this conversation, resistance. How do you resist that notion that this work would be second best?
That's a good question. I have been saying yes to opportunities as they arrive because opportunities are opportunities. And so that doesn't feel much like resistance, but I think the ways in which I do engage, I continue, I guess I'm refusing to make work that compromises the way that I make work. And so if I'm offered an opportunity to program offsite or online or any sort of virtual way of programming, I insist on continuing to do what it is that I do. So I'm doing a performance that involves me basically kind of ignoring the audience while I do what it is that I do, and I'm refusing to mediate that in a way that makes it easier for people to digest because of the fact that it's mediated a little bit. I can't allow the art world to claw back the ground that I've gained as a disabled artist in some of those resistance forms in those ways of refusing productivity. So I'm staking my ground. I'm staking it out and digging in.
Amazing. And then in an earlier conversation that you and I have had, you spoke about a project that is related to your dreams and sleeping. Is that still something that you're working on?
I am. So a little publishing company called Noxious Sector Press just put out a book, which is my 10-year journal of dreams. And I've been making work about my dreams for the past couple of years. And I plan to continue making work about my dreams into the foreseeable future. one of those projects. I make a lot of work about dreaming, about beds, about sleeping, and they weren't tied together in any conceptual way when I first started making them, but I think through the dream work, I'm trying to tie them together a little bit more. I feel like this work is very selfish and self-indulgent, but I never use those words in ways that are less than absolutely positive things. I think as artists, we should be self-indulgent and we should be selfish, and we should be making work that is absolutely interesting, that is fascinating to ourselves, that we should be making work that's relevant to ourselves and our communities. So I'm indulging myself, especially through the pandemic, in doing work that's interesting primarily to me. And I think what I've learned through my practice over the past couple of decades is that if it's something that is compelling to me, that I make well, it will be compelling to other people.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think the idea that being selfish and self-indulgent is a bad thing is a really flawed notion. Because I think that when we are creating work, whether that's in our jobs or in our families or in our communities, that is like rooted in serving ourselves, like that can overflow into a service to our communities, and also really remind people that they can also be selfish and self-indulgent in a really positive way. And yeah, I think that's a really good point, that when you create work that you want, like that's going to have value.
Yeah,
inherently.
Yeah, and I think that it's another mode of resistance to not constantly be saying like, how is this work contributing to society? How is this work selfless? And what am I giving to the world? And how am I being productive for this machine that we keep talking about, this capitalist or neoliberal machine that I'm meant to be a part of? Like, what if this is for me? What if I am talking to people that are important to me? What if I'm talking to people that are also resisting? What if we stop looking at ourselves as people that need to contribute and start looking at ourselves as people that that need to that need to be there for each other, and that need to be there for ourselves, and that self-care doesn't necessarily have anything to do with being productive for anyone else besides ourselves.
I was going to ask you what advice you would have for emerging artists who find themselves in similar, who are also finding themselves, you know, in that place of, you know, people who are just out of school or things like that, are coming from academic institutions, going into the art world, who are coming up against all these things that you're speaking about. So I kind of feel like you just answered it for me with that. So,
I mean, I like to tell, when young artists ask me about my practice and about how to be, how to make work that is a little bit more open-ended, or work that is resistant, but without knowing what the answers are, like, none of us have answers. I don't have answers. That's what I tell them. I don't have answers. I don't know the way we should live. I don't know how to resist. I think people should be making art that asks questions, not that makes statements. I think all the best art is by artists who go out into the world and say, I have a question and I'm curious to know the answer, and I'm going to try to find out the answer. And I hope that you're curious enough to come with me on this journey.
Yeah. And then kind of on a similar vein, but like when you look at the Canadian art sector, what is your dream for it to evolve into moving forward? Like in your wildest dreams, what does the Canadian art sector look like? What does it feel like? How does it operate?
Wow. I mean, right off the bat, in my wildest dreams, Canadian art institutions are a lot more diverse. And that's diverse in all respects, in terms of who they employ and the kind of art that they exhibit, the kind of artists that are invited to have a seat at the table. I mean, that's institutions as in galleries and funding agencies and schools, from the institutions that are creating artists and that are telling people what art is, and making art visible and making it viable. I think the whole sector needs some massive shaking up, and I would love to see it start with diversity. Beyond that, my dream is for artists to be able to make a living doing what they're doing, or at least to be able to make a life doing what they're doing. And even if not all of us can make a living in the arts, we should all be able to have a life that centers our practices while we do the other things that we need to do to make a living.
So Cindy, one thing that we talked a lot about in this conversation is the resistance of productivity of bodies, especially the resistance that disabled bodies need to take against the cogs in the wheel of productivity. How would you say that disabled bodies are different and or similar to the concept of a failing body?
So I curated an exhibition, a performance evening a couple of years ago called Earthly Tents in Edmonton. And it was from a quote from, I think, Corinthians about these earthly tents, in other words, our bodies being shrugged off in order to make our way to heaven. And I sort of liked the idea of bodies as tents. And I was trying to think of ways that I could start as a disabled artist talking about bodies' failure that wasn't equated with disabled, that there's ways that bodies can fail on able-bodied people that don't necessarily put them in the realm of the disabled. So I've seen a lot of people taking on the word disabled because they have a body that's starting to break down. And I guess I push against that a little bit at the same time as I don't want to gatekeep the world of disability. But basically I was asked to curate an exhibition for a dance company. And as a disabled artist, I wanted to make work about disability. And at the same time, I kept thinking about who it is that I wanted to involve. And all of these people were suggested to me as, oh, you should work with this dancer. She's getting a little bit older and her body is falling apart. And I bristled a bit at the idea that I would have to invite all these people in that wanted to be a part of this discussion because of the fact that, like, oh, I've been dancing so long that I've developed these foot problems or I've developed these knee problems. Like, that's great, but that's not the conversation I want to have. I want to talk about people with disability. And so I'm going to take the idea of disability and split it off from the idea of a failing body and talk about what it means when people who are disabled want to talk about their bodies as failing, so that we can allow ourselves to have people with bodies that are considered othered and with bodies that are considered less able, that don't want to talk about their bodies as failing. And so I involved people with all different kinds of physical and mental disabilities in this project that did want to say, like, this is where my body is failing and this is what I want to say about it. And it was really, I think the project was really beautiful because of the fact that it was disabled people talking about their vulnerabilities and talking about the ways in which they didn't have to try and pretend to have good bodies for these able-bodied audiences. They didn't have to prove themselves as worthy of being watched, and they didn't have to prove themselves as, like, I'm good enough to perform for you and look at me transcending my disability for you. They said, look at me in my body and what it's capable of, and I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm upset about, or what isn't working for me, and I want to talk to you about the things that maybe I'm afraid of and that you're definitely afraid of about my body. And it was a space for people to be really vulnerable in front of the people that are probably the most scary to be vulnerable in front of, which is not just able-bodied audiences, but dance audiences.
So when you spoke about earthly tense, you spoke about this idea of bodies as tense. And for me, I was kind of thinking about what else happens when our bodies are kind of completely at rest, and when we're sleeping, when we are sleeping, and then what happens that is productive when we're sleeping is not only are we resting, but we're dreaming, and dreams and sleep have come up a lot in your work. Could you talk about some of the other projects, exhibitions, curations, performances that you've done relating to dreams and sleep?
Yeah. So I think where the dream work started for me is that I've been keeping this journal of dreams for the past 10 years. And I basically write down the dreams and then I never look back at them. So it's a journal that just goes forward and generally doesn't go backwards. I didn't think of it as an art project when I started keeping track of my dreams, although I thought that there might be something generative about it. And after about 7 or 8 years, I decided to read back on some of the dreams. And as I read them, I realized that I didn't recognize them at first. So I would read a dream, I would experience it as though for the very first time, as though it was somebody else's dream, as though I'd never read it before. And then slowly it would wash over me the idea that this is something that I know very well, and I know well enough that it might in fact be a memory of something that really happened. I could smell the smells and see the sights and hear all the audio of the dream. And I really, it was really effective, really, really made an impression on me. And so at the same time, I was going through a series of, I was remembering a trauma that happened as a child. I mean, I remembered the story leading up to the trauma, and I didn't remember the trauma itself. So I was a child and I was actually abducted. So in this trauma that happened to me, basically, I'm 3 years old riding a big wheel tricycle, and these two older boys start taunting me. It was a very powerful event that I remember very clearly. And I didn't realize until my mom recounted the story to me that the memory actually stopped there. And her retelling of the story starts much later than that. She remembers the point when she realized that I was missing, that she went looking for me, couldn't find me, eventually found someone who thought they saw someone who saw these boys leading me in a certain direction, and she went looking for me, and I don't know who all was involved in finding me, but eventually they found me. And her, the important part of the story for her is that the parents said, oh, our boys would never do this, but in fact they did. So to her it was a cautionary tale about parents not believing their children could do any harm. But for me, I realized, like, oh, there's a whole chunk of my life that's missing that I never realized. And I grew up thinking that I could not be the kind of person that ever had that kind of trauma happen to them. And realizing that it had, it suddenly gave me a whole new conception of how my brain works. And as someone with disabilities that affect the brain, I realized that I had a lot more thinking to do about my brain and how my brain works. And so I decided to take this catalog of dreams and see if I could use it as a way to try and pull up memories from the past that had long been forgotten by pulling these dreams out to the surface, pulling out memories and trying to revisit traumas and see how I might be affected, how I might be changed, how my world might be changed by bringing these things back that had been long buried.
Wow. That's beautiful, and thank you so much for sharing your personal part of your life. Are you working on dream work right now, or is it kind of like an evolving practice?
It is. I don't know, I just made this sort of arbitrary decision that because I had a journal that spanned 10 years, that I was going to spend the next 10 years making dream work. And for me, it felt like a way of removing some of the pressure of art making. If I had sort of an outline of what I was going to be working on, then my brain wouldn't have to spend too much time worrying that where the next project was going to come from, or worrying about like how my work fits together and what's going to be next, and how people are going to conceptualize my practice as having these through lines. I just know I'm going to make this work about dreams, and I'm not going to worry too much about how it fits together. I'm just going to focus on this, and really it's about how can I be changed and how can the world around me change by revisiting these things that, I don't know, that seem to have no value to the rest of the world, that seem to have no value even in my world. You know, we think of dreams as really frivolous things that might, you know, signify something, but in fact, it seems like a good way for me to continue my practice of resisting productivity and being anti-capitalist by focusing on something that some people would think of as so frivolous. So I think the projects that I'm doing these days really capitalize on that continued desire to resist productivity by looking at a dream that I had, asking people who were in the dream to help recreate it with me, and then having these really quiet moments that an audience is welcome to participate in, but maybe they don't have a way in the same way that one person does. A lot of my performances, I build at least one or two levels for people to engage with that that not everybody can, that's maybe not for them. And that's, I think, one of the ways that my queer politic and my disability politic and my fat politic comes into my work, is that I speak to people using a language that maybe the rest of the audience doesn't necessarily have. Sometimes I'm speaking specifically to queer people, or specifically to fat people, or specifically to disabled people. And we're sharing a moment, we're sharing an experience that the rest of the world doesn't have. And the whole project doesn't have to be about everybody. It doesn't have to be for everybody. So I had someone approach me once and say, I get it that this work is really queer, for example, this work is really queer, but don't you think you should make it accessible to me in some ways? I'm not queer, so I don't understand this work. And like, honey, this work is not for you. This work just isn't for you. And I think a lot of my dream work is going to be like that. Even, and it's not specifically for queer people or disabled, like maybe it's just for one person, right? Maybe this work is just for one person very quietly. And I think that in itself is a form of resistance.
So, Cindy, we're coming to the end of this conversation. And again, a massive thank you for joining us today. I know that the folks who are listening to this episode, or who are going to be reading the transcript of this episode, are going to garner a lot of knowledge and a lot of questions that they can ask themselves about their practice. And so, for anyone who is listening who wants wants to get in touch with you, get in touch with your work, how can we find you? How can we get in touch with you and follow your work and your practice?
Yeah, my social media handle, Instagram and Twitter are Cindy B, that's CindyBee. My Facebook, where I spend a lot of my time these days, is Love Cindy Baker. And my website is cindy-baker.ca.
And the last question, all of our Crypt Times episodes, is what has been bringing you joy recently?
Water. Water has been bringing me joy because I've spent a lot of the summer in water. I've been in Ontario for the summer, which is not where I usually find myself as a prairie-based artist. And I have access to a swimming pool that I use almost every day, and I've been swimming in lakes almost every day. And I can't even begin to tell you how much joy I get being in.
Crypt Times is presented as a part of the Wheels on the Ground podcast network. This podcast is produced by us and supported by Tangled Art Plus Disability and Bodies in Translation. If you enjoyed this interview, we release new episodes every Monday wherever good podcasts can be found.